You can now hear Film Actually on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or WebOS device. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, no memory wasted. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com.
Death doesn't like to be cheated.
I've seen this before. A lucky few survive the disaster, and then one by one, death comes for them all.
It'll be much less terrifying if you just come to me.
Wolfman's got
nerve. Make love in the hammock.
What?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Actually, episode 54 for the 3rd of September, 2011. I am David McVeigh, and I am joined by Josh Philpott. How are you, Josh?
This is just odd, man.
It is
this
a little
is just
bit odd.
So weird. Like, you started off, and I just was not ready. And I just want to make it clear to everyone who's listening to this show that we're all wearing ridiculous hats right now.
Yeah. I'm not wearing pants.
Yeah. And we should make it. Why not? Because, like, we can get away with it. Seriously, though, can you put that away?
Yeah. Well, normally I'm sitting down, but you really want to put it away?
that other voice you're hearing, by the way, is Richard Gray from The Real Bits. How are you, Richard?
Well, pantsless, obviously.
It could be Richard, but we could be lying because there's no way that you can
see me.
For those that don't understand what's going on.
But who else could imitate this wonderful voice?
For those who don't understand what's going on, for the first time in 2 years, this show isn't live. And it's a very odd sensation, not having a chat room, not having a camera on us.
You think that's odd? Try not wearing pants during the show.
That's going to be a running gag all episode.
No, third's the charm.
All right, some news updates. First of all, I guess we should get... welcome to Film Actually, the official movie podcast of geekactually.com. And this week we are going to be reviewing... Well, we're going to do a big review, and we're also going to do a little minor review, I've decided. A little minor review. We're going to review, basically, we're going to go back to the world of death, and we're going to review Final Destination 5.
You say we're going to go to the world of death and we'll review Chalet Girl.
And we're going to do a mini review of Chalet Girl, which is opened. And this mini review is for you, Jane.
Thanks, Jane.
We're also doing a brand new list of five. Now, in watching Final Destination 5, it occurred to us that after 4, and go back and listen to Geek Action number whatever that was, whenever we did that horrible film as a review.
I blacked out. I don't remember much.
I don't even remember what episode it was. We really didn't like number 4, and when we got invited to number 5, it was like, I don't want to. But we did, and surprisingly, in our review, you'll hear more, but surprisingly, it actually wasn't, it didn't suck as much. It didn't have the level of suckitude that we thought it was going to have, all right?
Suckitude.
So it inspired a list, and we basically said 5 sequels that didn't suck as much as we thought they would. We will come back to that at the end of the show. Normally you could watch this show live, but not right now, because we're in the process of moving, as we said in a previous show. And so the update on that is we do have a new premises. We have a new studio. We will be moving in the next week or so. So for the next 2 weeks, I think, we're still not going to be live. Hopefully, we will be live not next week, but the week after. I'm not sure.
You guys
sure.
can
we'll
all
see.
Surprise us by coming back with like triple the amount of viewers because you are so into
absolutely.
The fact
absolutely,
that
would be fantastic. Like, it'll be the same channel, same place to find it, geekactually.com/live.
Same bat
time, same bat channel. Same geek time, same geek channel. All right, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, so we'll be moving, so things are a bit chaotic. This is why we're not doing them live, because we just never know when we can record at this point. Like next week, it will not be on a Saturday. Next week will be some other time that we'll figure it out. But yes, it is all moving along now quite nicely. So that's the news that's fit to print. What have we been watching, guys? Everybody scrambles for lists.
Okay. I'm still tracking through Monster, which has reached...
I need to get the series off you, by the way, because somebody recommended it to me again the other day as
dude,
well.
It just... gets incredible. Like I hit a point where a story arc breaks off from the main arc and has this epic crescendo of like a story within a story,
right?
And it not only adds a huge amount of weight to what you're already watching, in itself, it's just an epic six episodes. Like, all of a sudden, your characters just disappear and you're introduced to an entirely new set of people, and then you run a storyline which runs parallel to something that's already happened.
What episode are you up to? Because there's like 50 or something.
Yeah, no, there's 75, and I'm up to about 30 now. So I'm giving that a good start.
Yeah, I've been told by a couple of sources now that this is a must-watch series.
I have bought but not watched, but I thought you especially should know about this. I went into JB and bought for $30 all five Planet of the Apes films, like the original.
$30?
$30, DVD including or Blu-ray? DVD, but it comes with the five. And then also it comes with Behind the Planet of the Apes, which was
so this is the one. This is the set that used to come in the ape head. They've just released it as a box set, right?
Just as a box set for $30. Yeah, no, it's I'm definitely looking forward to making a marathon out of that.
Yeah. I will be going. If they release that on Blu-ray at that price, I'd be even happier.
Yeah,
I would check Amazon or Amazon UK. They get some pretty good deals on the Blu-ray box set.
About to say the Fox region codes, though.
Amazon UK will be fine with.
Okay,
it's about £14 for the five of them or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, I might have to have a look at that.
That translates to.
I'll be interested to hear what you think. I've seen all five films, Josh. I'd be very interested to hear how you go
with
those.
I imagine that I will struggle after about three of them.
My chart is first Planet of the Apes, great. Beneath the Planet of the Apes, suckitude. Third Planet of the Apes, probably worse.
Yeah.
Fourth Planet of the Apes, not bad. That's Conquest. That's where the apes rise. Kind of what Rise of the Planet of the Apes is kind of loosely based on. And then Battle kind of falls back down again. It's kind of this really... It's a sine wave. It really is. Yeah. But
I do remember really enjoying Four.
Four I liked. Yeah. I like it. Let's go. Ricardo Montalban.
No way. Ah, dude, I'm totally in. That film's going to be amazing. Montalban.
Or as we'll always know him, Khan!
Oh, we're such geeks. Really, we are. I watched The Incredible Hulk again last night.
Oh, nice.
Speaking of being geeky.
The newer one?
The Louis Leterrier reboot.
I actually watched that about 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, I watched it on Blu-ray last night. Really enjoyed it. I had so much fun.
Yeah, I haven't actually. That's the only one I haven't got on Blu-ray for some reason. But
Look at it on Blu-ray. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, no, I definitely want to pick it up. But I also plan at some stage in the next year, and probably closer to the time of the Avengers comes out, watching them all together.
Yeah, I actually I said to my son the other day, I said, we need to sit down and watch all of the Marvel films, not even just the Marvel production ones, all of the Marvel films, the Fox, the Sonys, everything else, in release order.
Yes. Wow.
So starting from X-Men 1. So
is that before or after Blade?
Oh, you could go back to Blade, yeah. Okay, go back to Blade 1. We'll go back to Blade 1 and then watch them all. Because there is actually a website I found that actually lists all of them in chronological order.
Because that would mean you'd have to watch Blade 2 and 3.
I like Blade 2.
Blade
2
is good.
I like Blade 2.
Del Toro, isn't it?
Yeah, Del Toro. And that's the one that's got my favorite line where he goes, "You don't know who you're fucking with." I love that line. Yeah. As only Wesley Snipes could deliver. Yeah. You know? I really enjoyed that. And what else did I see this week? My God. My mind has gone blank. I've watched films every night this week, and my mind has gone blank. Oh, I watched Fast Times at Ridgemont High on Blu-ray. I love that film. Fast Times at Ridgemont High, very early Sean Penn. Also, blink and you'll miss them, but look for Eric Stoltz, Anthony Edwards, Nicholas Coppola. Jennifer Jason Leigh is one of the stars. Phoebe Cates bears her breasts in her first role.
That's not a movie title, though, just in case.
Phoebe Cates bears her breasts. It should be a movie.
Coming this summer.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High, really funny film, but the film is made by Sean Penn's Spicoli. His character, Spicoli, is brilliant as the surfer dude. I think summed up by when he says, "Have you tried the new weed yet?" And he goes, "Listen to this," smashes a shoe on his head and goes, "Hear that? That's my skull. I'm so wasted." really fun film. Enjoyed it a lot. And I know you're going through 80s films, so there's another one for you.
I have seen Fast Times, but I'm definitely going to check it out again. Probably it's only a couple of years ago, but not like.
I like the trivia behind Fast Times. I remember when the film actually came out back in the 80s. I was in high school when it came out, and I remember hearing the stories then. It's always been like legend, and it is confirmed. When Cameron Crowe wrote the book, Cameron Crowe, of course, went on to write and direct things like Almost Famous Say Anything. He was a young prodigy. I mean, basically, the character, young kid in Almost Famous, is based on him. He was writing for Rolling Stone magazine at the age of 16 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when he decided that he wanted to do a book about teenage life in high school, he decided the only way to really do this is to go back to high school. So he went and enrolled himself in high school. And because he was so young looking, they bought him. And he went and did a year of high school taking notes on everybody and then wrote the book, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which then he wrote the screenplay for as well. And you just sit there and go, yeah, that's chutzpah. You know, that's you just walk into a school and say, yeah, can I enroll in senior year of high school? And they don't even bother to find out whether he really, I mean, he was 20
something. It's true. And he kept this up throughout his whole career because for Jerry Maguire, he actually became a dickhead for a year.
That's a lot easier to do, though, I
think.
So anyway, sorry, what have you been watching, Richard? You've got a list.
I've got a little list. It's not a huge list this week, but I, staying in the 80s, on your recommendation, I saw The Sure Thing.
Great film.
Which is a great
and
film.
Our opening credits, Make Love in a Hammock, that's from...
From The Sure Thing. Great film, and I did it as part of an 80s...
Good for you.
As David Derry said, I'm doing an 80s kick at the moment. So that was the first one.
I've been doing that for 30 years. You
know? Yeah, well, the thing is, I'm doing an 80s kick at the moment. I say that because I've started a column on my site that's looking at a new 80s film every week. But really, I watch a new 80s film. I watch something from the 80s fairly regularly. My girlfriend Susan's very much into the era, particularly, you know, the John Hughes kind of thing. So that's why things like Pretty in Pink and
Some Kind of Wonderful
and Breakfast Club keep turning up on my lists as well. Yeah. So absolutely.
It's a good era, man. I love it. It is my era. That's the era that I always come back to. It's my fallback.
In the last week, I've also seen, speaking of the 80s, the new movie of The Smurfs.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Which wasn't the train wreck that I thought it was going to be.
We'll actually review that in more detail in 2 weeks. But yeah, I agree with you. It wasn't awful.
No, it's got some decent writing in some scenes. So someone's come in and done the dialogue, I think, afterwards, and it's quite good.
There's a ghostwriter who's come in and tidied that up a lot. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was somebody that we know. But
yeah, absolutely. Maybe Joss Whedon came in and did
it. You know, if he wasn't so busy with the Avengers, I would say probably. Yeah. But,
but someone like that's come in and done it because, you know, there's references in there to passive aggressive Smurf and things like that.
And the Brokeback Mountain.
There's a Brokeback Mountain reference that I didn't see coming. I also saw this, apart from the two films that we're going to review today, I also saw a movie called Snowflower and the Secret Fan, which is getting a release here in Australia.
Now, you missed Zookeeper for this. I missed
Zookeeper.
Was it worth it?
Look, I suspect it was.
I imagine if he had stayed at home and done nothing, it would have been
which
better.
Is what I did instead of to see Zookeeper.
We're sorry, but
yeah.
I apologize to Sony in advance. I just couldn't make it. After the day I had, I just couldn't.
And the guy was in the country, too. I mean, you know, we still didn't decide to go. No, look, I really enjoyed it. Do you remember Wayne Wang?
Yeah. Slam Dance, one of my favorite films.
He's been a bit quiet for a few years. Like he's made big films like The Joy Luck Club, and he made two of my favorite films, which were Smoke and Blue in the Face. Mm. These little indie films from the mid-90s that had like everybody who was sort of big on the indie scene at the time. And then he sort of went quiet for a few years and made things like Made in Manhattan.
He was an indie darling back in the 80s. He did a film with Virginia Madsen. We talked about Virginia Madsen the other day. He did a film with Virginia Madsen called Slam Dance, which I just adored when it came out. It just really tickled me.
Yeah, and like, you know, and he was just a cult movie. I mean, he had movies like Eat a Bowl of Rice before that and all those kind of things. But this is sort of half Chinese language, half English. It's mostly in English, but it's about these two parallel stories about these two girls who have grown up in modern day China. One of them's moved to the States, and sort of their lives and how they've changed and how they've grown apart. And this parallel story about these two characters in historic China who have a very similar life. It's just really well done. It's a chick flick, I'd say. It's
nothing wrong with a chick flick if it's well done.
And in that sense, that it's a movie about women for women. And it's which he's
that's
really good.
That's a theme of his,
which
though.
He really does well. It's like The Joy Luck Club in that sense. So look, I went with a woman who loved it, who said it was one of her favorite movies of the
you
year.
You went with a woman?
I went with a woman, the lovely Susan, to use her full title. And she loved it.
Who
so,
isn't listening today? Because we're not. Did I remind you we're not live?
We're not going live, but she might listen to this later. Right. So I have to use her full title of the lovely Susan.
Absolutely.
You also have to be nice, otherwise she'll kick you.
Kick my ass.
Find yourself sleeping on the couch.
Yeah, well, we have two couches, so as long as I get the comfy one,
okay,
that's fine. Cool. Yeah, so that was what I saw this week. And I started watching Green Zone this morning. The Paul,
Well, Josh and I reviewed that on the show, the Green Zone.
I'm not getting into it.
You won't. It doesn't get any better.
Actually, funnily enough, yeah, I've got one more to add that I just remember that I have tried to watch for the third time now and still failed to get anything further than 25 minutes into it, which is the new Friday the 13th film. The 2009 one.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
Oh, is this the remake?
I just don't care. It is fucking terrible.
No, the remake is awful. I ranked that remake right up there with Final Destination 4 and Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, but it's just, there is nothing to like. And I just find myself going, would you just fucking get on with it?
Yeah.
Like, there is so much unnecessary character building for character. Like, they set up characters in the first 5 minutes that die in the first 15. It's like, we didn't need a story for these people. Just axe them and move on.
Yeah, the only thing that film is not going for it at all is the fact that it actually is nicely shot. It looks good.
Yeah.
But like Conan, Marcus Nispel doesn't know how to direct horror, let alone action.
You know what I love as well, man?
I don't know. Because Friday the 13th and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, his previous film, made a bucket of money.
Who's he fucking, though? That's what I want.
Michael Bay, apparently.
It must be. What I love, man, though, is that when you watch My Bloody Valentine, the remake, you can separate... is it Jared? No, the other guy. The guy that plays Dean in
Supernatural.
Supernatural.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can separate him and make him a character. Mm. When I'm watching Friday the 13th, I can't stop thinking about him as Sam.
Look, My Bloody Valentine is a stupid film. There's no doubt about it. But it was so much fun to watch because it was taking the mickey out of itself half the time. It's almost like there's that gratuitous nude scene in the middle of the film where she's fully frontal nude for so long. Yeah. It's almost like they said, you want a nude scene? Here's a nude scene. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. And they just extended that for like 10 minutes. You know? And you sit there and go, all the way through it, they're kind of taking the piss out of themselves. Yeah. You know? And I love that about that film. And the guy who directed that went on to do Piranha, didn't he? Isn't that the same?
Yes.
That's the same director, I think. Yeah. I could be wrong about that, so don't write in. We have computers. Can somebody
look that
up?
If we're not live, we can edit this out.
I won't, but you know, that's but yeah, no, I like My Bloody Valentine, but I agree with you 100%, Josh. I thought Friday the 13th was, but I didn't like Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake either. The Jessica Biel one. I really got nothing out of that.
I like Jessica Biel in
Texas. I liked her. I liked her little white shirt that she wore throughout the entire thing. That sounds incredibly sexist of me, I know, but come on, there was you could only take the superficial from that.
You're
film.
Talking to someone who, in the last three times I've been on the show, I've been drooling over a certain picture of Olivia Wilde.
I don't have the board set up.
So I can't look. Don't worry, I've got it on my computer. Here.
Okay, good.
I'll open it up throughout the show.
We'll just open it up every time you hear him go. That's what he's doing.
And remember, I'm not wearing pants.
Oh, I don't even want to think about that now. Oh, man, what have we done? Put that visual image in my head. All right, we're going to move into our feature review.
It's probably for the best.
Probably for the best, which, of course, is Final Destination 5, directed by Stephen Quayle, not the bird, and written by Eric... written by Eric...
I don't get it.
I can't even pronounce this guy's name. Heiser-er?
Yeah, no, it seems like there's one too many errs on the end of that. I had to check my...
Is that a spelling mistake?
No, that's how it's spelled.
I had to check that three times before I published my review.
Heiser-er-er. So, whatever.
Heiser-er.
I'm sure there is actually probably a Germanic pronunciation of that to make sense.
It's Heiser-er.
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 You need to be able to roll R's to do that.
Heiser-er.
I can't roll R's, so... Let's move on. It stars Nicholas D'Agosto. These people get a real name. You know, $40, you know, the name registry, you can change name. You know?
It gets better from here.
Emma Bell, Miles Fisher, Ellen Rowe, Jacqueline McInnes Wood, PJ Byrne. You say that one.
Alan Escapeta.
Thank you. David Kushner, I think
Kushner,
it is.
Kushner, maybe?
No, there's no R, so it's going to be Kushner.
No, because it's Germanic.
Ah, so, Kushner.
Kushner.
Courtney B. Vance we can do. And, of course, Tony Todd, who manages to make his way into, three of these films now, I think it is. So, Tony Todd, for those who don't know, was the Candyman. So, he's no stranger to horror films, and now he's basically Basil Exposition.
And he makes the world taste good.
He makes the world taste good. In Final Destination 5, death is just as omnipresent? Omnipresent? Omnipotent? I would have said, omnipotent. But anyway,
I think omnipresent.
Omnipresent as ever, and is unleashed after one man's premonition saves a group of co-workers from a terrifying suspension bridge collapse. But this group of unsuspecting souls was never supposed to survive. This all sounds very familiar at this point, doesn't it?
I've seen it all before.
And in a terrifying race against time, the ill-fated group frantically tries to discover a way to escape death. I cannot read today. Frantically tries to discover a way to escape death's sinister agenda. And this source is straight from Warner Brothers. That's probably why it's badly written to start with. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's basically, you could have summed this up by saying, somebody has a vision, saves a bunch of people from a disaster, and then the rest of the film is them being picked off one by one by death.
Well, that's the great thing about when a film becomes a franchise. It's like the rules are set up. And if you're watching and if you're watching five without watching the rest of them, you're getting what you deserve. It's like, if it doesn't make sense... Yeah.
He watched the five without watching the rest of them.
And
as it turns out, I think I have seen the first one, but point taken.
Like, and it's fine. Like, I don't think it's actually too much of an issue because it's one of those things.
Oh, look,
where
it's really self-explanatory because you got Tony Todd being Basil Expedition.
Absolutely, and look, I mean, it's good to do it that way because that's essentially what you should be doing with your films now. It's like, set it up in 10 seconds. What I love about this film is that they don't bullshit around the fact that you are fucked. Like, it's not maybe death's coming for you or maybe you can avoid it. It's no, you're going to die. That's just reality.
They make some pretty quick decisions after Tony Todd turns up. It's like, we're fucked.
Right, hold that thought because we're not live. We're all out of sync. Let's watch the trailer real quick and then we'll come back. And I want to hear Josh on this because Josh really hated the fourth one. Wow. So I want to hear what he's going to say. Here's the trailer.
Trying to get all the pieces of the puzzle together. It says right here in the statement, I knew it would happen.
I had a vision.
We knew to warn everyone the bridge was going to collapse.
Everybody off the bus!
And minutes later, it did. I'll tell you what I believe. There's an answer for everything.
Authorities aren't calling the bridge collapse a freak act of nature.
It's natural causes?
Yeah, more like supernatural.
Death doesn't like to be cheated.
I've seen this before. A lucky few survive the disaster, and then one by one, death comes for them all.
Are you saying we can't stop this?
You're not supposed to be here, so let death have somebody else in your place.
Wait a minute, we kill someone, we get their life?
When we're done, you'll have perfect vision. I'll be right back.
That is the only way to watch Bold and the Beautiful Star die.
Oh, absolutely.
Wasn't it just glorious?
You know what's great about that trailer is that it makes you really... When I saw that trailer to start with, I thought, well, that's just given away all the killings, hasn't it? And it really doesn't.
No.
Because I think the great thing about Final Destination is that it toys with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
The whole time. And you think you're going to see... It sets up all these... You know, horror porn's gotten... Sorry, I'm gonna have a little rant.
Go, do
here.
It. But I'm with you on
horror
this, man.
Porn is a term that's been bandied around a lot in the last few years. It's usually used to describe things like Hostel and Saw and stuff, where it's like gratuitous.
Well, that's like
horror.
Torture porn as
but
well.
But you know what? I think this is more analogous to porn because it's kind of like it's showing you everything. It shows you the bits it's going to play with. It toys you for a while and then you get the money shot. And you know, you know exactly at the end of that scene, you know what they know exactly how they want their audience to react. Mm-hmm. They know exactly, we all know exactly what's going to happen at the end of the scene. I think one of our good friends, Jorge from the Spotlight Report, said that they may as well have had Fatality flashing up on
Mortal Kombat. That's
Mortal Kombat. We know it's how we're going to win, but it's kind of like a porno because you just know at the end of that scene, you know.
And you know,
you don't know how it's going to happen.
You don't know how it's going to happen, but you know it's going to happen somewhere.
And they meticulously set up at least 15 ways that it could happen.
No, but this is
and you
the
watch
difference.
It going, where's, where and like, when? You know?
This and, was, and sorry, I just going to say one thing is that one scene that you saw a little bit of where she's dancing on the, the gymnast the beam, is dancing on the beam, and you think, okay, well, this is going to end it. And it's toying with you for a good 5 minutes, and then when it happens, you don't see it coming.
Yeah, no. And this is one of the brilliant things about this. I love actually on that line about you calling it like torture or horror porn, as you said. A guy behind me straight after that scene where she gets smashed entirely at the end. We won't abridge, you know, sort of how she dies because that's kind of the fun of it all. But this guy behind me, it must have been 45 or 50, just turned around to whoever he was with. And I just heard it in the back of my head where he was like, why are we even watching this? And I was like, as a human being, I understand what you mean. But as a horror fan, shut the fuck up and get out of my cinema. Yeah. It's like, essentially, we all came for the same reason. We knew it was going to be gratuitous. We knew it was going to be ridiculous.
Rush.
Exactly. And, well, more than that, it's truly keeping that horror essence, unlike Four did, where it's like, it's about the suspense of the kill. It's not about the kill. The kill is 2 seconds.
Yeah. And I'll have to stress right off the bat, this film is not scary.
No.
It's tense, it's tight, and it's gory, but it's not scary. In fact, I haven't laughed so hard in quite some time because it is so extreme.
Oh,
and the deaths are so outrageous. And you sit there I was just...
That's the word. It's outrageous.
It's outrageous. Mm. I was dying. I was laughing so hard. Yeah.
It's true. He was dying.
I was dying.
We didn't help him at all.
All right, so Josh... Yep. From the man who literally was almost tore down the studio after Final Destination 4, hit us with it.
Well, look, I mean, the great thing about this film is, number one, from moment dot, like literally from credits roll, it is paying homage to everything that's before it. And it's almost like someone's looked at what 4 was trying to achieve. It's looked at the over-exaggerated 3D. It's looked at the fact that it's very aware that it's the 3D is a novelty in the film. Mm. It's looked at the fact that these kills have to be extreme and intense. It looks at the fact that what the best kills in the series have been are the ones that you never see coming. It's like it's looked at all these things and they've put together an absolutely solid film. Like, this is I agree with one of the writers that writes for me at Hip Hop Net, went to see it with you guys, and he said when he walked out, he was like, this is the best film so far. He's like, I would put this better than 1, and I actually agree. It's like, I know that there are problems with this film. I'm aware that there are huge like things that I think are camp or stupid or something like that. But it's a tight film. It's well written. It's shot incredibly. Whatever cameras they were using for this film,
I'll make a bet it was probably Epic Reds.
Epic Reds. Exactly what I said in the cinema as well. It's like, it's beautiful to watch. The opening scene, which is of course, like you said, like that is the big money shot. The first opening scene is always the heavy duty death scene. And that was absolutely staggering.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Yeah, like great CG.
Yeah, the bridge sequence
brilliant
was amazing.
Deaths and quick deaths, like quick sharp deaths, like when the dude gets hit by a cable and stuff like this, just wham, you just don't see it coming. But because you've watched the series, or if you haven't.
Well, the thing is, halfway through that scene I kind of thought, "Oh, I know what this is."
Yeah.
And I still thought, "This is brilliant. This is
exactly
great way to start."
Well,
a
not
film,
even that. It's also you start counting who dies when.
Yes.
So you know the order in your head, so when you're watching the movie, it's like, it becomes fun. Like, the whole thing becomes fun, because it's like, you know who's going to die.
Yeah.
They're not going to bullshit you around about who's going to die. You're following the order. All you're in it then for is the deaths.
Exactly. And I think you said this before, which was like, the film doesn't waste any time in sort of coming to the point and saying, right, we're going to dispatch you one by one.
Yeah,
we know that. You know that. Let's get on with it. And that's so much fun just to watch that happen. And you're kind of complicit in this thing.
Yeah,
I always remember years ago reading American Psycho, the book, and one of Bret Easton Ellis's points in that film, because you're kind of reading through this book, going, oh, the killings are getting escalated and escalated, and you're becoming complicit in these killings. And then you get to the last killing, and you kind of go, oh, is that it?
Yeah,
and it's exactly. Like, that's when he's got you, because, you know, he's got the point. You know that his point is that, you know, we become desensitized to violence. But this is kind of the complete opposite. It wants to keep making you
Yeah, and the thing is,
laugh hysterically.
Not, by the way, I just got some details. It's not shot. It's actually shot in Aeroflex. It's actually shot dual strip film.
Oh, well, no wonder
it looks so good.
Well, the thing is, his background. He was a second unit director and an assistant director for James Cameron on Ghosts of the Abyss and on Avatar.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's obviously been hired for his 3D expertise.
Because this is shot Arri RAW dual strip 3D source format. So it's shot 3D, which is the first big plus. And it's,
You
know? Exactly. It's like, it's well put together. And like what I found interesting is when you get to the end of this film, my two gripes with the film is I think the relationship stuff was just a waste of time. Like, I was getting really bored during that time because it would move so suddenly from either a death or a really intense scene to them talking and just went on too long. Like, it should have been done well moving or between things. It's like the fact that they stop the film and have a conversation in a room every time was kind of like, guys, seriously, you could have done something with that.
I'm glad you said that because that was actually something I felt and other people I've spoken to have felt through the movie, which is there are long patches where it does feel a bit dull. And I don't think, I think the overall effect that I remember walking out of that was, God, that was fun. But there are points during the movie where I was kind of looking at the watch going, right, can we get on to the next killer now?
And one of my favorite things about it is when it gets to the end, because like you were saying, there is in a lot of these films, the last killer's kind of a, it's kind of a letdown. Whereas this just goes all out. Like, the actual final death in this film is probably the dumbest out of the lot, and it's so sudden.
But what I love about it, though, is it's completely set up. You know it's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet you just sit there, and you start to smile. you know it's coming.
What I think rounds it out, what makes it perfect, is the fact that it goes straight from that into AC/DC doing If You Want Blood, and then just runs through every kill you've seen in every one of these films. Yeah. And it's just like, that's the homage bit there. It's like, we are aware this is silly. Yeah. We are smart enough to be able to make this work. Mm-hmm. And I just walked out going, I just had a bucket load of fun. Like, to give you guys an idea of how little I wanted to see this film, number one, we had four daunting over my head. Number two, I had to go pay for the film. Number three, it's not playing at the Ritz.
Oh,
so I had to go to Bondi. $23. Now I had to go to Bondi to pay for 3D prices to go see this film.
Which is what we did for Final Destination 4.
And you know what the funny thing is? I was totally happy with paying my $23. I felt like I got an absolute blast out of that film. I got what I went to the cinemas for. Yeah. I got big budget, big screen action, and it was in 3D. Really well shot 3D, and that was the great thing about it. The opening scene of this film is great, where it's just things coming through glass, and I don't know if that's CG or whether they actually threw that stuff through glass.
Oh, I'll make a bet it's all CG, but it's some of the best CG work. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. Yeah. And considering it was only a $40 million budget, they really used their money well. Well, it wasn't on cast, obviously, because it was...
Let's come back to the cast.
They did manage to get Tom Cruise, though, didn't they?
Almost.
Yeah.
I don't even know what his name is. Do I even bother looking up his name?
I had it here.
I think it was Miles Fisher, I think is the name of the guy, who looks like, sounds like some young wannabe Tom Cruise. And as soon as I saw him on screen, I went, oh my God, he's trying hard, you know? But he has no emotional depth.
It's astonishing how much like Tom Cruise he's doing. He's doing the hand movements. He's doing the head movements.
Last time I saw somebody who wanted to be Tom Cruise this bad was the guy who plays Captain Jack in Torchwood.
I looked him up. In superhero movie, he played Tom Cruise.
Oh, well, there you go. if you've ever seen the film... Megalodon, which I know Josh has, Shark Attack 3. The guy who plays Captain Jack Harkness in Torchwood.
John Barrowman
was in that film. And that was long before Torchwood. He was very young. And in that film, he's like this guy. He wanted to be Tom Cruise. He had the same mannerisms, the same smile, and all that. And it didn't suit him either. Look, there is only one Tom Cruise. Leave him alone.
Thank God.
You know, thank God. And everybody stopped trying to be him because, you know what? If you were Tom Cruise today in the business, you might not be as success like he was. It was a time thing of his time. You don't need to try and be...
He was an 80s guy.
Yeah, you don't need to try and be somebody else, be your own guy. And this guy really just wants to be Tom Cruise, and he's awful.
But that's kind of the thing about him. It's like he's awful, but Celine actually brought this up, and I think it's a brilliant point. She said you can't have people in a film like this that you're actually going to enjoy watching. The concept behind it is that these people have to be kind of irritating.
They're fodder.
Yeah, they are complete fodder, and they have to be annoying. They have to be traditionally, you know, like the same kind of way, no matter what it is. Like, you know, you have to have kind of like the douchebag and the prissy chick.
Yep, yep.
And interestingly enough, mildly racist with the black guy there. It's just, I don't know what it is. It's something about him being
the token foreman. Black guy.
No, but actually being the work foreman. So the rest of them have cushy office jobs and you've got
and he's the factory working worker.
Yeah. You've got the factory working black guy. I was like, you know, I'm not black, but this is mildly insulting to me.
What did McKissick think of that?
I don't know. I haven't asked.
We should ask him when he's out of that because that did strike me as well. And I like the fact that they still made him an executive because he had to go off.
He wasn't in the office.
No, no,
I love the fact that he shows up in the workroom. I'm like, whoa now. And then it's like, yeah, now I'm gonna have to fire people, you know, being his boss and all. And I'm like, yeah, no, still.
Someone actually said to him, what are you doing off the factory floor?
Look, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I actually really recommend this film. I really enjoyed it. Yeah. I think that I love the setups. I thought the deaths were really unique. I was like, you know, having Tony Todd come in there and start spouting off all of his mumbo jumbo. You sit there and go, I even buy you. You're fine. You know what I mean? I have no problem with that. I mean, I always thought Tony Todd's character was kind of a pointless character that they had to bring in because people who watched this film who didn't understand what was going on, I sit there and go, I fear for mankind. You know, that you actually need somebody to come in and explain it, you know?
But I kind of like the fact that they've put him into the film in a similar kind of a role, but he's kind of around this, and that's what I actually kind of really started getting into.
Well, the opening clip where he actually, my favorite line in it is where he goes, I don't have anything to do with this. I just clean up the mess afterwards.
Dude, and he was absolutely having fun with that role because when he finishes his speech, I'm not sure if you guys noticed this, but for people that are going to go see this film, when he finishes his creepy speech at the end of that thing, he does the finger twirl and spins. And I just could not let that go. I was just like, that is amazing. Well done. He's just like, and I'm out. And he just rolls out of the scene. And it was great because the man has perfected creepy. It's what he's basically done as a lifestyle. But yeah, like the other thing I have to say is I actually welcome this series as a horror fan and as a film reviewer. I welcome this series into the franchise list now because it's gone.
Congratulations, Final Destination.
It's gone to five. It survived its bad film. Because I'm not sure if you guys are aware of that, and I'm saying I've written a thing about this, so you guys can head over to hiphopnetonline.com. If you want to check this out, but there are certain things.
Was that hiphopnetonline.com?
Thank you, dude. Well, I figured if I just said hiphopnet, people wouldn't be able to find it. So, but the thing about it is,
we'll put a link in the show notes.
All right. Let's move on. But the thing about it, there are certain requirements to a horror franchise to put it over just a horror series, which is the fact that you have to survive the bad film.
Yeah.
The bad film can kill your series.
Quite frankly, Final Destination has actually survived two, though, to be fair. Because it survived part two, which was also really ordinary, but part four was awful.
But it was ordinary. That was the difference. Two was ordinary, and you get that throughout horror series. Mm. Jason is like Friday the 13th is full of average films, right? But the thing is, there's a few deaths. Exactly. Yeah. There's a few deaths or a few inventive camera angles or something. There's still something in them. And it's like when we watched two, it didn't kill the series for me. I would have happily watched the third one and did watch the third one. Four killed it for me. Four, I was like, I'm not doing this again. I can't. But when you watch five, it becomes a franchise because it's like it survived what should have killed it.
And it's the thing we were talking about just before the show. We were looking at the directors because this is a new guy who's taken over, a new team, and they've injected new life into this. When you look at the original, though, and you go, okay, so James Wong comes along, makes this very inventive horror film, which nobody had seen anything quite like it before at that point, and was a big hit.
Yep.
And then David R. Ellis, who was the man who went on to make Snakes on a Plane and soon The Shark Knight coming out, made part two, and part two was as we say, pretty ordinary. James Wong came back, cleaned up the mess, made part three with the roller coaster, and you go, okay, we're back on track again. And then they brought David R. Ellis back again to sink it one more time, you know, with part four.
Yeah.
And all I can think is, David R. Ellis, this is not your playground.
No.
You really don't know what you're doing in this playground. Go off and make Snakes.
I don't think he knows what he's doing in general.
I don't either, because as I've said on the show before, I'm not a huge fan of Snakes on a Plane. I
thought it was all right.
I can see some camp things. I like the idea of Snakes on a Plane. I like the title of the film. I like Samuel L. Jackson's line. I like elements of it, but as a film, it left me really cold.
Exactly.
Which kind of makes me worried about Shark Night, but I'll keep an open mind.
This is what I've said about David R. Ellis before. He's a stuntman whose first directorial effort was Homeward Bound 2, Lost in San Francisco.
Wow.
And then he moved for that. It was some 7 years later, he followed it up with Final Destination 2.
So, because he made such an impact with Homeward Bound 2 that they had to.
And then he's made nothing but horror films since then. So clearly, perhaps he should have stuck to dog films.
But the problem is, the problem that I have with David R. Ellis is the fact that his horror films all make money. And this is why they keep hiring him. You know, and that's the problem. Is that
Picks smart films. It's not so much the fact that he ever puts in enough effort to make something decent. It's the fact that it's just smart film choices. And that's why.
And you look at it, also just his plot lines. I mean, in the first Final Destination, James Wong went with a plane crash, right? In the second one, David R. Ellis has a freeway pileup. You know, it's not real inspiring, right?
No.
Then James Wong comes back and does a roller coaster, which is kind of really fun. And then David R. Ellis comes back and does a racetrack.
Yeah.
You know,
The racetrack was just so bad. And it's funny because in those final scenes of 5, you notice that there is very little from 4.
Except the engine falling on the girl, which is actually probably the best gag of the whole thing.
The only good gag of the entire film. Yeah. And it's funny because it's like, that was where they still had me, and from there they lost me. And it's like all the two scenes of the car coming off the road and the engine hitting the girl, and that's it. And then the rest of them are from the other one.
The other scene I didn't mind in part 4, and we're not reviewing part 4, the other scene that I think had potential, which he lost because he didn't really pull it off very well, was the travelator escalator in the supermarket that fell apart and everybody's falling in the gears, you know? And you sit there and go, that had potential, but David R. Ellis didn't know how to sell the gag.
Exactly.
Mm. And given that scene to this guy, Quail, and you go, I could see something really interesting coming out of that.
Exactly. Yeah? And it's like, I can't fault this film. It's like, as a horror film, horror films are not meant to be perfect. That's the aim of a horror film. It's like, there is stupid camp shit. There is unnecessary stuff. There is stuff that doesn't quite make sense.
And look, if you don't like gore and you don't like being, you know, the suspense and the whole, you know, build up to it, don't go see this movie. Yeah. This is not for you. But if you like the setup and the gag. When we say gag, we're not talking about the joke. We're talking about the effect or the stunt or whatever it might be. If you like the build up and then the final gag, this is a great, fun film. What are you looking at?
So look, I love Internet Movie Database sometimes. I love the list. I just found this while I was looking up David R. Ellis. Someone's created a list called 10 Greatest Movie Directors of All Time.
Worldwide.
Okay, number one, Alfred Hitchcock. I think we can all agree
there. Yeah, I'm there.
Yeah.
Wolfgang Petersen, number two. I wouldn't agree, but he's made some good films over the years.
I think he's a brilliant director. I wouldn't put him in number 10. I wouldn't put him in the top 10.
Number three was John McTiernan.
I wouldn't put him in the top 10 either.
Number four was Catherine Bigelow. Number five was Kurt Wimmer.
Kurt Wimmer?
Yeah.
Hasn't he only directed like two films or something?
Equilibrium, that's about it.
Number six.
Ultraviolet too, Joe.
Oh, wow.
Number six was the guy who directed Speed, and I'm going to say it's Andre Butt.
No, he didn't direct Speed.
Oh, sorry, he's cinematographer on Speed.
Yeah, he directed Runaway Train.
Runaway Train.
But let's not forget that he also directed Tango and Cash.
And then so far, let me recap. Our list is Alfred Hitchcock, Wolfgang Petersen, John McTiernan, Catherine Bigelow, Kurt Wimmer, and the guy who directed Runaway Train.
Andre Bartowski.
Andre Bartowski.
Barkowski.
Bartowski.
Yeah, whatever.
Rob Cohen.
No.
Who's in there. Now, then Jason Reitman. Okay, now I should point out number 10 is Steven Spielberg. Number 9 is David R. Ellis.
I'll get fucked.
There's your connection.
I actually would have put Alfred Hitchcock followed by Steven Spielberg, maybe. You know what I mean?
So, Dana Lee Klug, your list has been read out on Film Action.
Yeah, where's Martin Scorsese? Where's Francis Ford Coppola? Where's Terrence Malick?
Look, they've all made good films, but...
But
you
not
know,
like David R. Ellis or John McTiernan.
None of them made Die Hard, you know? So,
wow,
yeah.
Die Hard and Predator. Other than that, what you got?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
All right, let's move on. I think we can all say that we recommend Final Destination 5. If you like a good horror film, go have fun. It's worth the money, and you'll enjoy this
film. If you like a bad horror film.
Just go for the fun of it. And look, don't take any of it too seriously. You will have a good laugh, if nothing else. It's very fun. I liked it a lot. All right, we're going to do a little mini review. The reason why it's mini review is because Josh hasn't actually seen this one, and I don't really want to spend a lot of time on this. We also got the opportunity to see Chalet Girl. Now, the reason why we're going to talk about Chalet Girl is because we've been putting a lot of stuff on our sites for Chalet Girl because it's been heavily promoted. And so we thought it's about time we probably just got this done and out of the way. So, Richard, I'll start with you. Oh, no.
By the way, just so that you guys know, I'm just going to zone out.
Yeah, that's fine. It's completely understandable. All right, let's just talk about some details here, and then we're going to get your opinion on this. Chalet Girl, directed by Phil Trail, which he needs to like lose an L, all right? Yeah, because it's too many L's in his name.
It's Phil Trail with two L's. Yeah, it's weird.
And written by Tom Williams. It stars Felicity Jones, who I think is a real up and comer. I think she's got a lot of potential.
She's in a couple of big things coming up.
She was in something else I just heard about or read about.
She's in Like Crazy, which is coming out soon. That's the one, Anton Yelchin. Yeah. He's also an up and comer.
Big time.
Yeah.
Ed Westwick from Gossip Girl. Bill Nighy.
From everything.
Brooke Shields from Blue Lagoon.
He's like the white version of Snoop Dogg. You only laugh because you know it's true.
It's true. Tamsin Edgerton, who I spent the entire film going, I know you, why do I know you? She is Guinevere in the new Camelot series, so I finally picked that one out. And Bill Bailey, who I absolutely
Dead Set legend.
Absolutely. All right, pretty tomboy Kim Matthews, 19. I don't know why they had to put the date, her age in there.
I think it's because they're going for the slightly older audience. They want to point out that this is not a teen comedy.
Right.
It's a late teen comedy.
Used to be a champion skateboarder, but now she's stuck in a dead-end job trying to support her dad. Opportunity comes knocking in the form of catering job in one of the most exclusive chalets in the Alps. At first, Kim's baffled by this bizarre new world of posh people, champagne, and skiing. But when she discovers snowboarding and the chance to win some much-needed prize money at the big end of season competition, but before she can become a champion again, Kim's going to have to dig deep to overcome her fears hard enough without the complicating factor of Johnny, her handsome, though spoken for, boss. And that comes from their official site.
Wow.
So
that's
you know, I'm going to stop using official sites. I think we're going to have to start writing our own because their blurbs really don't do these films justice in any way, shape, or form.
No, that's pretty close.
That's pretty close. Here's the trailer. We'll have a quick look at this and then we'll talk about it.
I'm Henrietta. Isabella. Patronella. Kim.
Dear Dad, I've made it to the Alps in one piece. Life as a chalet girl has its ups and downs.
A chalet girl who can't ski? That's classic.
Still, it beats life back in England.
And today's special, 2-for-1 and onion rings. Please don't push.
I've made a good impression on the boss. The locals seem friendly. And despite the long hours,
this is your fault. You are welcome.
I'm starting to discover
Johnny.
This job definitely has its perks.
Like that, she became a swan.
So I used to be an ugly duckling then.
I know I'm lucky.
But I'm stuck in this caged existence when I just want to be a pop star.
Rock star.
No sleeping with the clients. Unless they're fit. Season ends. He goes back to his world. You go back to yours.
She's a chalet girl.
I just think you can do better.
Kim!
Felicity Jones, Ed Westwick, Tamsin Egerton, Sophia Bush, Bill Bailey, Brooke Shields, and Bill Nighy bring you a hilarious new comedy.
Yeah, they always say that.
That was quite funny.
You're a natural.
About how far you need to go.
Thought you said she hadn't been in the mountains before. She hadn't.
To conquer your fears.
Yes!
And enjoy the ride. Chalet Girl.
I'll put the photos on Facebook.
Poke me.
Okay, Richard. So, what are your opinions on Chalet Girl?
Now, if I like this, am I out of the club forever?
No.
Okay, I'm going to let you go with that one as well. I've got no reason.
No, you'll be surprised. You're going to be surprised to hear what I've got to say about it.
I assumed from that trailer, which kind of does it justice, but doesn't. And I should point out,
the trailer sums it up. It sums up the story.
Story
perfectly.
Nicely. It's actually kind of fun. And you're out of the club. Yeah. It's the No Richards Club. We've already got one. I actually had a lot of fun with it. We saw this because it's been so heavily promoted, and one person in particular.
We love you, Jane.
With Jane, Jane's been promoting this one a lot, and
Jane's our Black Widow, isn't she?
Jane is our Black Widow, or what's the character that Cobie Smulders is playing?
Oh, Maria Hill.
She might be our Maria Hill.
Sorry, it's an inside joke, people.
And she, like, I've been promoting heavily. So, of course we went and saw it when it came out, and because we'd seen so many behind-the-scenes footage and clips, I think we'd seen half the film by the time that we actually got to it. But yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. It's predictable as all hell. But it's got a really good cast to start with. Yeah. As we've said before, Felicity Jones is really big up and coming. She's going to be in absolutely everything. She's in a movie called Like Crazy, as I said.
She's the next Mulligan.
Oh, Carrie Mulligan. Quite possibly. Yeah. Because I think she's got, this is the movie she kind of had to do to get to that place. But all the supporting actors are excellent. She got Bill Nighy. Brooke Shields isn't looking so good as David
and
was saying.
She plays a bitch and she does it okay.
And Bill Bailey's fabulous as always. But you know what? This is what it is. It's not. Let's not dick around. It's pretty much a straightforward girl meets boy from the different side of the tracks, and they can't get together at first, and I'm not going to give away the ending. what this has done is it's thrown in extreme sports to keep you to keep it something different. So we've got,
and look, and to be fair, the skiing stuff and everything is all really
it's
well
really
shot,
good
really
and,
well shot
and so you got
it's live. Did you see that behind the scenes?
Yes,
they actually put the cameras on skiers and ski backwards, and they did it, so it's all live skiing. It's all really well shot, and
it's really good.
That's fine.
So they've basically blended two.
It's all kind of pointless, but
it's
fun.
Pointless. They've basically blended two really well-trodden genres, which is the rom-com and the sports movie.
Fuse them together,
and they are exactly what you'd think. Two well-worn, genres fused together, doing exactly what they did in their respective genres. But it's fun, and at the end of that, kind of like what we said, I hate to compare this to Final Destination 5. It's like what we said with that. The conventions from the start. So
look,
I'll
go so far as to say that I had as much fun watching Chalet Girl as I had watching Final Destination 5. Look, I actually quite liked Chalet Girl, and my first thought when I walked out of the cinema was my lovely wife Katie is going to adore this film because she loves rom-coms, and it's a really well put together little rom-com. And the thing about a rom-com is it has to be predictable. It's one of the formulas of the rom-com.
Strangely enough, Susan didn't like it,
which I think is very interesting. but I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. I thought the characters were charming. The first half of the film is stronger than the second half of the film. I think the second half of the film becomes even more predictable because the second half of the film is more of the sports movie, as you were saying, the two fused together films. And as the sports movie part, that was incredibly predictable. You could almost pick every beat that was going to happen. Whereas the first half of the film was her getting to the chalet, getting to know the quirky characters and all that sort of stuff. And that was much stronger than when she finally dons the snowboard.
Absolutely.
But with all that being said, even that was not painful. There was never a moment where I sat there going, oh, I've got to get out of this cinema. I can't stand this anymore.
No,
I actually sat there and I had a smile and it was charming and it was cheerful. And we have these little interjections all the way through from Bill Nighy or from Bill Bailey to help move things along. And they keep the comic nature going. I actually thought the guy from Gossip Girl was going to be horrible because I actually don't like him on TV whenever I see him, but he's bearable. And as I said during the trailer we were talking, Tamsin Edgerton is gorgeous, the girl who played Guinevere, and Felicity is charming. There's a real charm to that girl, and I think
very likable.
And if she doesn't become a star, there's something wrong, because
it's a very British film too, which I think is what separates it from, if this had been done in the States, what would have been,
it would have been schmaltzy cheese.
And there's that very quirky British sense of humor to it, and I think the presence of Bill Nighy and Bill Bailey bring that quirkiness to it.
But then you've got all the foreign, like the Finnish snowboarder dude, and then you've got all these wonderful little quirky, and that's one of the things the British do so well. They bring these weird quirky characters.
It's like, Bill Bailey's characters, his little thing that he keeps eating beans on toast throughout the whole film, and his daughter's trying to, and he says, well, what's wrong with beans on toast? We won two wars with beans on toast.
And I love, he actually goes, she pre-makes him all these lasagnas before she goes off to the Alps, and he's trying to figure out how to microwave it, but he ends up just sticking his fork in it and sucking on the frozen lasagna as he walks away. It's gags like that are just charming, And so, I actually quite liked it. And I would actually say, if you're not going to go see Final Destination this week and that's not your kind of film, then you're going to do far worse than go see Chalet Girl.
And if you're going to see a rom-com, because I went and saw just before this week, so I didn't mention at the top of the show, Friends with Benefits, which
I have avoided.
Which is a pile of shit. And if you're going to see a rom-com, you know, most people will probably see Friends with Benefits, but I would recommend seeing this film, which is probably going to fly under most people's radars.
Yeah.
But it is probably the preferable rom-com to go
and see. Agreed. 100% agreed. So, yeah, so there you go, Josh. You can come out of your hiding now.
All right. I'm good. I'm back.
Quick, play that clip of Shelley, girl.
Yeah, I've got some clips. I got some behind-the-scenes clips. Actually, with that being said, there are a couple of really, really fun behind-the-scenes clips. Yep. That one, if you go to geekactually.com, we've got it up there.
Or realbits.com.
Or realbits, you've got it up there as well, which is Bill Nighy basically talking about what a good snowboarder he is and doing all the and using all the snowboarder terminology.
Mm.
It is very funny. And it's like that's not in the film. That's just some behind-the-scenes thing he did. And that was very amusing. I liked it a lot. All right, let's talk a little bit about entertainment buzz, and then we'll get onto this list. We only have two stories in news this week.
Oh, they're big ones.
The last couple of weeks have been kind of quiet news weeks. Yeah, we've had lots of films announced, but it's all kind of boring, really. Can I just say that I watched the Hunger Games trailer? I was thinking about putting it on the show, and I thought, no, I'm not going to, because it's a really bad trailer. Mm. This is a film that is really highly anticipated.
No, I'm going to correct you there. It's not a teaser trailer. It's a teaser for a teaser trailer.
Pretty much.
And no, this is exactly how they pitched it. It happened for Twilight as well. MTV, some sort of MTV award comes along, and they play a short teaser for the trailer.
Yeah.
And this is to get you hyped. And this is one of the things I've been complaining about the last couple of years, is that the trailer has become the event and not the film a lot of the time, which is basically the marketing has become the event.
Yeah.
So, and you know, and in some ways this sort of segues into...
It's kind of scary to think that there's probably people out there that keep trailers.
Mm.
And it's kind of like...
I used to.
Yeah.
I used to collect them.
Yeah, I mean, there are websites dedicated to trailers.
I don't anymore. I used to.
Yeah,
well, I watch too many of them now to keep them.
And this sort of segues into our next story, because I remember when the Phantom Menace trailer came out back in 1999.
Yeah.
And I was on dial-up back in those days. And
I was just on cable.
I went to cable just after that, I think. But it was one of the first trailers. It had millions and millions of downloads. It was one of the first times that Apple trailers really came into its own. And that's what, 11, 12 years ago?
Well, I was talking to David Longo of DamnGoodCup.com after a preview a week ago or something like that. We were talking, and he was asking me about what it was like, because David Longo is very young, and he was asking me what it was like in 99 when that trailer hit, when the announcements of this new Star Wars film came out. And the reason we're talking about Star Wars, we got a big Star Wars story coming on here, guys. But he was asking what it was like, and I said it was insane.
It was,
It was insane. Every computer store you walked by, they had put monitors in the windows, and they had that trailer on loop.
Absolutely.
You know, you could see that trailer everywhere you walked.
I went to a movie because I knew that they were playing that trailer on the big screen. Yeah. It was John Carpenter's Vampires, I remember it.
And there was in America, there were people who were buying tickets
to
movies, watching the trailer, and then going home. They didn't want to even see the film, you know? It was insane, the level of anticipation for that film.
And then we saw it.
And you know what? And we mock it, and we say, oh, yeah, and then we saw it. But
I saw it four times at the cinemas,
regardless. The film did make $500-something million at the box office, and, you know, it was a huge hit and spawned two more sequels, and, you know. And I don't hate it. It's not the worst film ever made.
I saw it at the cinema a couple of times, and I think it was about four times. And I think each time I really wanted to like it, because the first time I saw it, and actually I think it was at the Ritz, I actually saw it. And I'd pre-booked the tickets, gone up there. We were sitting down, ready to go. The first frame comes up of Lucasfilm, a long time ago. We went nuts. I mean, it was absolutely mental.
Yeah, mayhem.
And then 5 minutes into that film, it all got very quiet, you know. We were nuts right up until just after Ewan McGregor says, I've got a bad feeling about this. And then we all started having a bad feeling about this. I became vegetarian that day. That's a true story. I have been vegetarian since the day
that... movie shattered you so much you couldn't eat meat.
So much ham in that film. and you know, but I think, going back to the trailer thing, I mean, that's what's happened with trailers and that sort of level of anticipation. We've built up the marketing so much that the film is inevitably going to be a disappointment.
Mm. Look, and the thing about Phantom Menace is that, as disappointing as Phantom Menace was, by the time we finished that prequel trilogy, Phantom Menace does actually become a slightly better film, because it actually makes more sense. There's more build. You can actually follow the storyline through and so forth. It's still not a great film, but, you know. And the thing is, I look at that and I go, it's a film for its time, for the 10-year-olds of this era, you know. And my son loves the prequel trilogy because that's his trilogy, you know. And he loves the original trilogy as well, but he doesn't have the same emotional attachment to the original trilogy.
They weren't made for us.
No. No, the original trilogy was made for us because I was 10 when Star Wars came out. You know what I mean? And so that was my trilogy, you know? And it's like there are 10-year-olds today who their Star Wars is the CG animated Clone Wars TV series. And that's their Star Wars. And so each generation has their own thing, you know? And I look at the prequel trilogy now and I go, the thing that the prequel trilogy has going for it is it has... It is astoundingly beautiful to look at. I mean, the CG work in it is, some of it is second to none in the world, you know? Some of it is a little bit cheesy and it doesn't work so well. Now, we bring all this up because the Blu-rays get released next week.
Yes.
And we're, you know, as much as we know that he's tinkered with them again, we still heavily anticipate watching them because you skip around the stuff that he's changed and you still have Star Wars in there somewhere that is going to, you know, key moments are going to look great. But it did come to our attention over this last week.
Oh, yes.
That George has been tinkering again. And I have a couple clips.
George!
So I thought we would have a couple, look at a couple of these clips and basically say, George, what have you done? And just to chat amongst ourselves here and say, why did he need to do these changes? All right, this is one. This is the first change. This is, we'll play the clip and then we'll talk about it. This is Darth Vader and the Emperor at the end of Jedi. And
this is the most infamous change.
This is the most infamous change. They've added something here that wasn't there before.
You will die.
Obviously, we didn't know what his emotional intent was.
No. I was always confused by that scene. It's like, you know, what's he
going to... Why did he lift the Emperor up?
Did he agree with him?
What are your thoughts?
I don't care either way. It's not that big a deal for me. I mean, it's like you say, I mean, it's unnecessary, but fuck, man, he's done a lot worse. Like...
Can I quote Simon Pegg on this one?
Yeah,
I'm gonna refer to my Jedi master Simon Pegg. Simon Pegg tweeted this week: "Always loved Vader's wordless self-sacrifice. Another shitty, clueless revision like Greedo and a young Anakin's ghost. What a fucking shame."
Or like this one.
Oh,
which is another one that you sit there and go, "This is a pointless change." For 30 years, we've had this sound effect. George, obviously, he's been sitting on this for a while and thought he needed to change this. Now, why did he feel the need to change Obi-Wan's scream to scare off the Sand People? For no apparent reason.
He's changed it before, I think. Actually.
Yeah.
I think he actually changed it for the special edition slightly.
Yeah, but slightly was still the same sound. More or less this one sounds like woohoo!
Yeah. You know, the thing is, and we're coming up to a couple of other changes which we actually agree with. So here's my thing. In some ways, we're very close to these films.
Probably too close in many ways, very close. As most geeks are.
But. Yeah, and look, they mean a lot to us, and that's why we're close to them, because you know they're a big part of our growing up, and regardless of which generation you grew up in, David, you're a little older than us.
Thanks for reminding me.
No, but I saw these in a different way. Now, I saw these in a different way to you. I saw Jedi was the first movie I saw at the cinema, so I would have been about 5 or 6 when Jedi came out.
Right. Oh wow, you are younger than me. Okay.
Yeah. So, so then I would have seen the VHS versions of the first two films. I wrote a piece on my site, therealbits.com. I wrote a piece on my site,
shameless plug,
which has actually been getting a few hits this week because of these changes, called "The Evolution of Star Wars." He's been changing Star Wars since 1981.
Yeah, the first change was adding a New Hope to the beginning.
And then he made a bunch of different changes. He made sound changes then. He's been making tweaks and special effects. There's a quote from that was on IGN this week. And I think it might have actually been quoting this New York Times article that you've got linked in the show notes, which is someone from Skywalker Sound, Matthew Wood, said every time we watch the movies, he's got something he wants to change. No shit. So there's obviously changes done to the films, visually as well as audio-wise. So there are some changes in the Blu-ray version that you'll have to find. Ha ha. That's always fun. It's because we meticulously put it all together, like, here's where it was, and then he'll update it. Now, I've got this.
I don't think that was so subtle.
I've got this. Yeah, then it goes on to say, but very, very, very small, subtle stuff. And the article finishes with fans have a very different definition of the term subtle.
Yeah.
Yeah. The no thing I have a problem with, because all of his other changes to date I've been able to live with, because, look, let's face it, it's his fucking movie. He can do what he wants with it. Mm. I've always objected to the fact that he's not made the original version available.
Well, he has once.
Yeah. But it's not in an anamorphic print, so it's still not... We still can't enjoy that in the same way.
What I would be happy with is for the $140 that we're going to pay for the box set of all the Star Wars
films, just stick it on there.
Just give us a Blu-ray of the original.
Absolutely.
Well,
and he can't bullshit us and tell us it costs anything more. He knows he's going to make money back on it. So don't bullshit us and tell us it's too expensive to do it. You've got the money, George. What are you... You know, you've just re-released these for the third time in the last 10 years, you know. Or 15 years.
And he's about to do the 3D releases as well.
Absolutely. They're all coming out. So we'll be buying these. What I object to, because film to me, and call me a snob if you want, but film is a historical medium. We can watch the changes in culture. We can watch the changes in history by going back and looking at cinema. It's our form of time travel.
Mm.
When you make changes to this and declare... The film that you loved sucks, I'm changing it, you will never see the film you loved again. You are changing history in a way that we can never get back.
And this is why I admire Spielberg for his most recent interview, where he basically said, yes, I made changes to E.T. and it was wrong.
Yeah.
And he said, and I don't want you watching that version. And he goes, and this is why we've gone to great pains to make sure that the original 82 version is available.
And I like the fact that he also said that from now on I will never do that
again. Jurassic Park is coming out on Blu-ray in October and no changes, you know?
And it's that is because it is perfect.
It is perfect. Leave it alone. Even with any mistake or flaw I might have, it's perfect. Leave it alone. You know what I mean? But, I'm not saying it has. I'm just saying all films have little mistakes and flaws and what have you. And you sit there and go, but that was the film that was made. That was the film... Jurassic Park made $1 billion. That was the film that made $1 billion, not any reworkings of it. You know what I mean? Star Wars, I have no problem if George wants to tinker with his baby all he wants. He owns it lock, stock, and barrel. They're his. Let him tinker with it all he wants. Some of his changes I agree with, some I don't. Fine. As long as he leaves the originals intact. You know what I mean? Give us the originals so that we can always go back and have that film to look at. That's our film.
He's worried about no one would buy his shitty versions, though, dude.
I agree. No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, so you put the original in.
No, but you wouldn't. I'm sorry, but people would just opt for the older versions.
Of course they would.
Of course they would, but this is why Spielberg has put the original E.T. in the box with... the anniversary edition.
Absolutely.
You know? And he goes, when you buy that, only watch the 82 version. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if George says, look, I want you to watch the other one, but the other one is here if you want it. Sure, people may only watch the original version.
But some might watch the souped-up version.
And I would watch both.
Yeah.
Because as an example, we got one last clip here.
Yeah.
As an example, this is a change that I agree with completely. Mm. When he released Phantom Menace back in 99, they tinkered with Yoda. Right, and they created this dumbass-looking, gnarly-looking puppet that had glassy dead eyes, and it just their idea was it was supposed to be 70 years earlier, so Yoda would have been in a different incarnation, and it didn't work. Completely didn't work.
They're 900 years old, Yurvich.
Exactly, and. According to Dennis Muren and his crew, they had been toying with a digital Yoda at that point, but they weren't quite there yet. So they went with the puppet. When they did Attack of the Clones, they had their digital Yoda perfected. And
boy, did they have
and
it perfected.
Their digital Yoda looks fantastic. It's got all the little jittery ears. I mean, it works like the puppet did, from Empire. And they did an amazing job. In the new Blu-ray version... For Phantom Menace, they have meticulously gone through and replaced the puppet with the digital Yoda to bring it in line with the other three in the trilogy. And it looks like this.
Be mindful of your feelings.
Your thoughts dwell on your mother.
I miss her.
Afraid to lose her, I think.
What has that got to do with anything?
Everything. Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
All right, so we've got a digital Yoda now that actually looks like Yoda and doesn't look quite as gnarly as it did. You know?
he looked like if Yoda was a pedophile, basically, in the original ones.
I love that. Yes, he did, though. It's very true. So I agree with that change. Little things like in the special editions when they were released, there were a couple of things I really liked. I really liked putting windows on Bespin. You know, in Empire Strikes Back, I really like opening the scope of that scene up.
Yeah, and the thing I liked about the ones for Empire Strikes Back was that they were very subtle.
Yeah.
They were very, very, very cosmetic. I've got two feelings about tiny changes. Some people say they're so tiny, you know, you don't even notice them. Okay, fine. They're so tiny, then why make them in the first place? Mm. You know, that's kind of my feeling change. No artist is ever going to be happy with their work.
No, but
if they'll stop being
artists. In original Star Wars, some of the changes on the special edition were on the final battle when the X-Wings come in. You can actually see the pilots moving in the cockpits and stuff. And that's really nice work. And you just sit there looking and go, it's really pretty, you know?
It's nice and all, but I still don't think it was necessary. I mean, I like those movies anyway because my mind took, you know, bridged the gap that you know, the technology couldn't make. And that's what a good film does. Star Wars isn't perfect, but it means something to somebody. But, look, you know, I'm not emotional to it. I mean, I love Star Wars and... Look, let's fuck it. I'll buy every version that comes out.
Of course,
out.
And I've already pre-ordered my box set absolutely. For Blu-rays, and you know, I'll have those next week.
But the thing is...
I want to know is, has he fixed... Because if he's going to... Well, we also know, I've seen the clip of the Han shot first scene. Mm. They've still got Greedo shooting first, but they've actually cleaned that scene up so it doesn't look quite so dorky now. Because if you remember how he does that little side jig, they've got rid of that. And in the new version, you see the laser ball hit the wall, but Han doesn't move, and then he gets shot. So they've cleaned it up. It doesn't look dorky. It actually looks like it works. But let's face it, Han still shot first, all right?
Yes.
There's no doubt about that. And that he can... change retrofit history all he wants. Yeah. Part of Han's charm was he was the rogue and he should have shot first.
Yeah. That's what's called a character arc.
That's a character arc, and that worked. One of the things that he added, and it was actually a scene that as a Star Wars fan we were all very excited to see, and it failed dismally, which was the scene with Jabba in the hangar.
Yeah.
The reason it failed was because the digital Jabba looked like he had been roasted. he looked cooked.
Yeah.
But then they brought a really, really good digital version of Jabba to life in Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
When he walks up in the pod race, you see him.
That's
coming
right.
Up to go, and he looks fantastic. So my wondering is, we haven't heard anything about this. Have they fixed that scene? I would love to see them fix that scene. Because that scene works.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that Jabba looked like
because
shit.
Because the scene was shot.
Yeah,
like,
it
back
was shot
in 77.
That's right.
The other thing is too, like, I mean, if you're going to do... I mean, we're going to see a version. Are we going to see a version in a few years, George, where you replace... Jabba and Jedi with a CGI version.
Not.
I mean, seriously, what's the difference? I mean, that's where all this is headed, right? He'll eventually replace, because he replaced all the other puppets in that scene with CGI
characters.
Well,
he replaced the band. Yeah.
And he's already replaced one Yoda with a CGI Yoda. I really hope he never touches
Don't touch Empire, man. You touch Yoda in Empire, I'm going to be pissed.
There will be blood, George.
Well, I think if he replaced Yoda in Empire, that's it. I stop buying versions.
You only buy one more version after that, and that's it.
No, I'm serious, because that's like sacrosanct. You touch that, there is no rhyme or reason.
Let's not mince words here. George Lucas is not an artist. He's a technician. He's made some good films in the past. American Graffiti is a great film. The first Star Wars is a good film. He lucked out on it.
And THX-1138, for its flaws, is a very interesting film.
But if you go back and you watch the documentary that came with Phantom Menace when it came out, it's about an hour-long documentary on the original DVD.
Yeah, I remember that.
I can't remember if it's on the Blu-rays or not. I don't think it is.
I thought the Blu-rays contained all the original material.
Maybe they do.
Hopefully they do.
There's some really shitty... extra features on those Blu-rays, but anyway, you see a man there who is clearly got it together business-wise, but doesn't know what he's doing artistically most of the time. He's got a whole wall of images that people have painstakingly put together. Some of them looked amazing, and he's walked through and seemingly arbitrarily gone, this one, right next, and that was his creative input. into the thing. And then they had to go off and technically make these things. And then you heard all these horror stories about him going, no, the light's not hitting it right. He spent more time on the look of things than he did
Harrison
on the actors.
Harrison Ford talks about that from shooting 77 Star Wars. He actually talks about the fact that George Lucas spent very little time with the actors. It was all about the mechanicals. It was all about making sure that that was part of it.
Ewan McGregor looks lost through most of Phantom Menace. He's clearly standing in a completely green room.
All right, let's talk about one last thing on this, and then we'll move on. But also surfaced this week was George Lucas actually did get in front of it was Congress, wasn't it? Yes, it was Congress. Yeah. He got in front of Congress. This was in a bid. This was in 1988, I believe it was, or 98. Was it 98 or 88? One of the two. Basically, he got up and – sorry, 1988, yes. 1988, he got up in front of Congress with a bunch of other artists to basically put forward a plea for taking care of artists and their belongings, basically, saying that it was wrong – that people go through and change artists' work, and an artist should be in charge of their own material. And I'll give you some quotes out of this, some juicy ones, where he says, "My name is George Lucas. I'm a writer, director, producer of motion pictures, and chairman of the board of Lucasfilm Limited, a multifaceted entertainment corporation. I'm here today as a writer, director. I'm not here today as a writer, director, or as a producer, or as the chairman of a corporation. I've come as a citizen of what I believe to be a great society that is in need of a moral anchor to help define and protect its intellectual and cultural heritage. It is not being protected. The destruction of our film heritage, which is the focus of concern today, is only the tip of the iceberg. American law does not protect our painters, sculptors, recording artists, authors, or filmmakers from having their life work distorted and their reputation ruined. If something is not done now to clearly state the moral rights of artists, current and future technologies will alter, mutilate, and destroy for future generations the subtle human truths and highest human feeling that talented individuals within our society have created."
Do you reckon it's like a? Do you reckon he's doing this as like a fuck you because no one's bothered to do anything about it?
No, this is something that I was reading an analysis of this. It goes on basically saying we shouldn't be artists should have control, sole control. Of their product.
He's basically going to say, you know, you can alter it, but I can do it.
And the interesting thing is what seems at first completely hypocritical of him, if you actually listen to his words, he's basically saying an artist should have complete control, which means basically even though he is altering and destroying his own work, it's his, and he is allowed to do it. Although Richard and I had this conversation the other day after Final Destination when we were walking home, and ultimately, though, he's also stepping on the work of Irvin Kershner and Richard Marquand, now who are both dead and can't defend themselves. But he didn't direct Empire. And he didn't direct Jedi.
And let's not forget all those hardworking special effects people who really broke some ground back when they were doing them in 77, 80, and 83. These are people whose work will never be seen.
No. And so George really seems to be prescribing to the auteur theory.
That's what I'm talking about. He actually says people who alter or destroy works of art and our cultural heritage for profit or as an exercise of power are barbarians. And if the laws of the United States continue to condone this behavior, history will surely classify us as a barbaric society.
Which is exactly what he's doing to his own work.
He's doing it to his own work. Now, he justifies it because it's his own work. But again, as I say, it's a historical artifact. And it's a historical artifact for a lot of people, all those people who worked on it. I've really never thought of it that way before, that there is work of hundreds and hundreds of people who will
Him.
Who will never be seen again if he...
Well, the actor who played Boba Fett...
Boba Fett.
...is gone.
Boba Fett, where?
His voice has been replaced by Temuera Morrison in all the earlier films.
That's
the
true.
Guy who did the voice of Boba Fett is gone. He's been eradicated from history. You know what I mean? And you just look at it and go, that's sad. He only had like two lines in the entire thing, and it's gone.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and you go, that poor guy, the poor bastard. You know what I mean? It's history. And there's little things like that in Star Wars all the way through it, where you sit there and go, somebody's work in that scene is gone. The characters who played the band and the puppeteers who did the band in
the
Max Rebo's band in Jabba's Palace are gone.
The people who wrote the Ewok song at the end of Jedi, they got replaced with whatever song they
John
used.
Williams.
There was a little Jabba.
John Williams.
John Williams.
But that song is gone. That track has been removed. It's not even on the album.
And actually, one change we didn't mention, apparently the Ewoks blink now.
Oh, yes. There was video of that, too. Apparently, they've digitally made them. And that actually works quite well. I was looking at that. I was watching the clip. It's very subtle. They've just given life to the Ewok's eyes because Ewoks never blinked before. So now they have a little bit of blinking going on. Okay, I can understand him wanting to do... I don't understand why he did it. What's the point in spending the money to do that? But if he wanted to do it, it doesn't hurt.
I'm waiting for him to then go and edit Caravan of Courage and...
Oh, no, I really want to go back to the Christmas special.
Oh.
What did you see? Go did you guys ever see that? Did you watch the new Robot Chicken Star Wars 3 special
yet?
Yes,
I've seen it quite recently.
Where they send up the Christmas special where they show up at Chewbacca's house and they're all dressed and he goes, "You've been naked this whole time." And Chewbacca goes, "I love you." I love Robot Chicken. All right. So yes, that's the word on George Lucas at the moment. And
Dick.
And we'll talk about the Blu-rays of Star Wars after we've had a chance to get them and watch them. Josh, are you getting the Blu-rays of Star Wars?
I'll watch them at your house. I'm done, dude. I watched Star Wars a long time ago, and I watched Star Wars. I didn't watch this bullshit that's being brought out now. And I'm serious. I will never purchase a copy of Star Wars.
Right now, I have really, really good rips of the DVDs of the original Star Wars, pre-New Hope, the original 77 release, The Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi.
That's Star Wars.
That's Star Wars. Yep. The original trilogy, unaltered, unmanipulated, in proper widescreen format, with the subtitles intact, and that will forever stay on my computer.
For me, every time these films come out with one little bit extra of something is like a film that I enjoyed as a kid being remade and just completely missing the point. And this is my problem. It's like, for me, it's art. And as you said, everything that gets changed fucks it up.
In so many ways, Josh, what you're saying is so true. It's actually worse than a remake. Because at least with a remake, somebody's coming along and trying to put a new spin on it.
Well, they're doing their vision.
That's right.
They're doing their vision. This man is destroying my vision.
This man is just
destroying his own vision.
The thing. A vision like that, something as epic as Star Wars, was a group of people. And this is what I'm saying. I watched Star Wars and enjoyed it because originally it was a fantastic film that was fantastically brilliant for its era. It was mind-breaking. It was mind-breakingly, you know, sort of innovative and all this sort of stuff. And every single digital ad that they put on it is fucking up what I saw back then. It's all, you know what it is? It's cheating. It's cheating.
It is cheating.
It was what it was, and it's not now.
Yeah,
so
look, I'm totally in the belief of Robert Zemeckis, Steven Spielberg, and a bunch of others who are all coming to the terms with the concept where you go, the film is what it was.
Yeah.
Robert Zemeckis said this about Back to the Future. He said when he released Back to the Future on Blu-ray, he said, the film is as it was made.
Yeah.
We've remastered it. We've cleaned it up. We've made sure there's no hisses or pops on the soundtrack. It's as pristine as it's going to get. And that's done. And that's exactly what they've done with Jurassic Park. Apparently it's been remastered and restored.
I watched the original, the first time that they re-released them with their editions. I watched that, but I watched that for one reason. So that I could watch them at the cinema, because I didn't get to do it as a kid.
Yep.
So I went in and I watched them, and then I went back to watching the DVDs of the originals that I had. Sorry, VHS tapes. Of the original ones that I watched. I have not watched Star Wars since then, and I will not watch it unless I get myself digital copies of the original, or I find myself videos, DVD copies of the original. Yeah. I will never watch a remake of Star Wars, and the only reason I will watch these 3D ones that are coming out is if I don't have to pay for them.
Yeah.
Because I will never give the man another dollar towards
those. Never understood why they bothered with that.
No.
Also, sorry, what we're talking about is there's a picture of the ring around, the shockwave ring around the Death Star. Somebody pointed out, though, really, really good point. They said that actually logically would make sense, because there is actually a center ring on the Death Star, which is the weak point. The problem is the ring comes out sideways, and it should have actually come out at an angle.
Yeah.
It actually doesn't come out from where the ring is.
It's just where the camera was looking at.
Yeah. Guys, don't give him any ideas. Let's just move on.
He needs to change that, I think.
You're right. Absolutely.
All right, one last piece of news, and we're going to do a list of five. Josh, I don't know if you've had a chance to see this yet. Richard's seen it. I've seen it. Marvel has released what they call a Marvel one-shot, which is what they call their one-issue comic books. They've done it as a film. This is a 4.5-minute video that came out to bridge Iron Man and The Incredible Hulk. These are all little movies that are actually building to the Avengers. Mm. They are so clever because what they basically do is lead into the post-credit sequence.
Nice.
So they kind of lead you where the post-credit sequence was supposed to go. This one is called The Consultant. For our listeners, we're only going to put an abridged part of this on, so you're not going to see the whole thing because it really is long. But for Josh, we'll play the whole thing, and we'll come back at the end after we've had a little look at this.
You hungry? I make great pancakes here. It didn't go well, did it?
No, it did not.
Did they reject the initiative?
Of course not. But they made the most idiotic, ill-conceived request imaginable. They want Blonsky on the team.
The Abomination.
They really don't like when you call him that.
What about the Harlem incident?
They're pinning that on Banner.
On Banner?
Not the guy you want to make angry. They consider Blonsky a war hero. They want him exonerated, released, and then added to the roster.
They think we have him.
What's your clearance level?
That's funny. It's level 6. Like you. Come on, there's a level 7.
Blonsky's in custody in General Ross's sector.
Does Director Fury even want Blonsky?
Of course not, but he can't ignore an explicit directive from the World Security Council. So we have to make sure he doesn't have to.
How the hell are we going to do that?
I have no idea. But we have to send a liaison to the general within 24 hours.
So on the council's orders, we have to send one of our people down to General Ross to ask for Blonsky, who we don't even want.
Exactly.
I got it. We send a patsy to sabotage a debriefing.
A patsy?
Yes, someone to screw it up. Someone so inept that General Ross will refuse to release Blonsky. I could do it. I do a great patsy.
Yes, you do. Your patsy's legendary. In fact, when I think of the word patsy...
All right.
You know, I'm thinking for this, we need a slightly different skill set. If we want the general to refuse this request, then we have to send someone who will truly annoy him. Someone arrogant and abrasive, with an utter disdain for authority. Someone who will offend the general to his very core.
You're talking about the consultant.
No, I'm not.
You just described him to a T.
I'm telling you right now, stop it. I am not calling the consultant.
All right, so that's pretty clever stuff. That's from The Consultant, which you can find on... We'll have the link in our show notes. There is another one coming later in the year. That'll be on the Thor Blu-ray, apparently. Yeah. And there'll be another one which will be on the Captain America Blu-ray, which will bridge Iron Man 2 and Thor. Mm. And it's called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Thor's Hammer. And so we will have that later in the year. So, Marvel's just got it going. They know how to market their shit. Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? They know how to put this together, how to make people interested. And look, I'm so keen for the Avengers. All right, let's move on to a list of five. And also, when are we going to get the Agent Coulson film, as Richard pointed out? I want the Agent Coulson film.
He deserves a film.
You know what? I think if they ever make a Nick Fury of S.H.I.E.L.D. film, he'll be
in
that.
They could make a Nick Fury of Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. film. They could make an Agent Coulson TV series.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Yeah, and you know what? And you get her to leave How I Met Your Mother, and you have Agent Coulson and Maria Hill.
Yes,
that'd be great. You know what? That's gonna win soon. They should do it cartoon style, and they should do it with the same artist that did the Men in Black series, so that they can basically just have them running around between all of the chaos that happens.
Damn straight.
And you can just have lots and lots of Pulp Fiction style dialogue. Of them driving along in cars, bitching about stuff. That's it'd be fucking great. I'm sorry. I think that's a
You know what they call Thor's hammer in Amsterdam?
All right, let's do a list of five.
Well, he's only got four.
I've got five. Count them, dude.
Oh, right. These aren't...
I don't have any also-rans this week. All right, my list of five. All right, so list of five. Five sequels that didn't suck as much as we thought they would. I said there are times when you hear about a sequel coming out and you just die a little inside. But then when you see the film, you are pleasantly surprised that it didn't kill a part of your soul. So we're not actually saying that these are even brilliant films.
No.
They're just five sequels that didn't suck as much as we thought they would.
Yeah.
Mm. And these are five. And I'm going to start, and I'm going to say my first number one is Jason X.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, this was a sequel that when I heard that they were putting Jason in space, I went, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, it very nearly made my list.
I can't believe that's on your list.
And it's been on Josh's list a couple of times, and I'm going to say that, because I actually quite liked it. It's just never managed to get onto one of my lists. But this is a situation where you go, that is a sequel that I thought would truly suck. And it didn't. Was fun. It's not a great film.
Yeah.
No,
but it was fun.
The only reason I'm not contradicting you is because of my number five. But anyway, moving okay. right along.
Okay, so yes, your number five
is Blues Brothers 2000.
Oh, see, now, it didn't suck as much as I thought it was going to.
I look, Blues Brothers, I worship the ground it walks on. And me too. Just this week, news has come in of potential TV series that Dan Aykroyd wants to do. He's gone a bit balmy because he's talking about doing Ghostbusters 3.
Oh, and he came out this week and said Ghostbusters 3 is going ahead without Murray, and that's just wrong.
Yeah. But, you know, Blues Brothers 2000 starts off in Dan Aykroyd's characteristic sequel fashion 20 years later.
Hmm.
Like, that's all the introduction you get. And look, you know, it's not going to recapture Blues Brothers. It never was. I thought it would suck completely.
Great soundtrack, though.
Exactly. The soundtrack is brilliant. The music they've got is awesome because Dan Aykroyd's a fan of all that music.
Yeah.
And they got some really good people on it. John Goodman's great, you know. Yeah. And so, and most of the original cast that were still alive came back.
It unfortunately falls apart in its last act.
It does. It absolutely does. But it doesn't suck ass completely. And thus, it is number five on my list.
Very good. Mm. Josh, you're number five.
H2O.
Yes.
Halloween.
Good call.
Now, yeah.
It's nice. The kind of film where it's like I walked out of that and I was surrounded by people and they're like, oh, that was terrible. It was horrible. It was a waste of time. Like, you know what? It's a fuckload better than the last two.
Well, after a string of really bad sequels to bring back Jamie Lee Curtis to basically just throw it to the wind.
And look, it's not perfect and it's really slow. It kind of goes back to that first one's mentality of just slow it the right down and just have him really meticulous and really slow moving. And I think that threw a lot of people because people were expecting the speed that they had seen in the last year.
But the thing is, I don't think anyone saw part six.
Yeah.
It was really hard to come by on DVD for years. Like, you could get one through five, and I think Anchor Bay released four and five about 7,000 times.
Yeah.
Six was, he was with Druids or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just saw it at the cinema.
Yeah.
Wow.
You're old. We've established this.
I tell you the one moment that... where, as an old person who saw these films in the cinema, the one moment of joy I had on all this was when they made the big comeback, which was Halloween 4, the return of Michael Myers. And it was like we'd had Season of the Witch and all that crap. Part 4 isn't a great film, but it has some good moments. But the part in Part 4, right at the beginning of the film, where John Carpenter's original theme kicked in.
Yeah.
And then a friend and I, who both fans of the first one, just looked at each other and went, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know? Look, it's like...
I think there's a lot to love in 4 and 5. They're the two that have Daniel Harris in them. And I actually think that they're decent films. I mean, they're not great.
They progressively got worse.
But I think 4 and 5 are okay for what they are, which is standard slasher films.
But to bring back Jamie Lee, H2O was actually realistically, there was a part of everybody's hope that H2O was the end.
Yeah,
they thought this was kind of like bringing it.
Resurrection doesn't count, man.
Resurrection
doesn't count. Busta Rhymes. Like, I mean, this was never meant to be good. Like, they were aware. You know what? I have to give that film one thing, though. That film started, and I only kind of retrospectively looked at it after Supernatural did an episode based on the same sort of camera style.
Yeah.
That film does deserve a bit of credit for the way they shot it, because the only thing that does work with that film is the fact that you are only in one house for the whole thing, and the tenseness comes from the way that they've shot it with those bad grainy cameras that are in every room, and it's like it's just the fact that you can barely tell what's going on that actually gives it that. After rewatching that film, I don't hate it as much because it gave other people ideas. It's one of those films. It's like I still think it's a fucking terrible film, but at the same token, it's like it did some interesting things. I think it deserves an extra point for that.
Fair enough.
But so, considering it's sitting on like three.
It's a point and a half or something. Yeah.
All right, my number four is Mission Impossible 3. Because let's face it, after Mission Impossible 2, we really didn't think there was any more juice left in this.
Yeah,
and
another one that I'd thought about. Yeah,
yeah, Mission Impossible 3, I mean, that's a damn good sequel.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and I really had no hope for it. Mm. Your number four.
My number four is Back to the Future Part 3.
Yes, agreed.
Because 2 was so terrible. And even at the time when I saw it as a kid, I hated part 2.
A lot of people did. A lot of people were really bitterly disappointed by part 2.
And because, look, I've mentioned this before on the show, part 1 is to me a perfect film. Yeah. And you know, I will not hear a bad word spoken about.
No, and I love. See, and I love part three is a fantastic second part to Back to the Future, which you unfortunately need part two to get to.
Because part two tried to recapture the magic, whereas part three just did its own thing.
Yeah,
and it was a Western, and it wasn't a Back to the Future film, but it was still a damn fun film.
I agree. Yeah. I agree 100%. Great choice. Your number four.
My number four is New Nightmare.
Yep.
Agreed. Yeah. Oh, I forgot all about it.
Like,
yeah.
It's one of those films. It's like you go back and look at what you had by that stage, like the crap we had churned out. Like we had taken it to interesting places, and this is the reason we watch all of the series.
Also, we finished the series. Exactly. And everybody said, why the hell are you doing another one?
Dude, and this is the thing. Continuity is kind of like something that is very often abandoned in horror films, but you have to kind of at least abridge it and, you know, sort of do something with it. And it's kind of like this was... It was encompassed, it was on its own, it was like its own film, but then at the same time was so incredibly faithful to everything that had been done before.
So
like,
little references and
exactly.
And
it's
the fact that it was a film within a film. Wes Craven's New Nightmare is very clever. It's
exactly,
very
and that's what I'm saying.
And this is before Scream as well.
It brought back kind of that concept, and it brought back, it's kind of like he's the anti-version of George Lucas here. It's like he was going back and thinking about what he had done and trying to do it again faithfully. You know, it was like, that was before he went crazy and just gave us a whole bunch of crap. It's like, the man was retrospectively thinking about himself as both a filmmaker and also as the film, looking back at a different, you know, from a different point of view, at a different time period. And it was like, there are so many ways to love that film.
There's these great little scenes in that film too. It's like Robert Englund painting and saying that he can't escape it. He feels compelled to go back to it. And you almost feel as though that's Wes Craven saying that. You know,
he can't escape it. Very much Craven's voice, that entire film. No, good choice. I actually forgot all about it. My number three is Clerks 2. Because here was a film that should not have happened because he claimed the Viewaskew universe was closed. He thought it was done. And I'm going to say Clerks was a time capsule. Why would you? And when I first heard about Passion of the Clerks, you know, and all this, and you are going, this is not going to end well.
And we'd already had the Clerks animated series.
We had the Clerks animated series, and
which
you
is
just
fantastic. What the fuck is wrong with you people?
No, I love it.
We're just saying we already had a series.
I thought
that
was kind of a
bad driving car. How can that be?
and then for him to basically say we're going to do Clerks 2. And then I was actually very pleasantly surprised that this was a film where you could see he was doing another very personal, this isn't a part of my life.
Well, and I think I've said this before, it's the film that you get when those characters grow up 10 years.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know? And it's like I was feeling exactly like those characters when I saw Clerks 2, which was, fuck, how did I get here?
It's not just about the characters, it's not just people, it's about an entire generation.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And that's what made it
work.
It's
about me, dude.
It's about me.
I
really, really liked it. I thought that closed the Viewaskew universe quite nicely. Absolutely. And there's been talk that Weinstein's want to do another Clerks film, and even Smith is like, why? what the hell are you thinking? You know?
He'd probably say, dude.
Dude.
Yeah.
No, he'd probably go, dude. All right, you're number three, Richard.
Oh, Star Trek. The J.J. Abrams Star Trek. Now, bear with me on this one. Some may say this is a remake, but we know it's actually a sequel.
That's true, because it falls into a different timeline.
Yes, it is a chronology. Right. And when I heard that, the reason why...
It is kind of a reboot.
It is a reboot / prequel / sequel. And I was hesitant. I mean, if you want, I can replace it with one of my also-rans. I can put High School Musical 2 in there instead.
No, keep Star Trek.
Okay. which is a fabulous movie, by the way. Star Trek, the reason I put this in here is because it is, because, you know, I don't want to spoil the film or anything, but let's face it, if you're listening to this, chances are you've seen it. It is a sequel because of some of the characters that exist in there. The reason I put this on this list is because when I heard that they were rebooting Star Trek, I thought, you dickheads. You know, why do this? You've got Star Trek. You've got 8-9 films already. You've got, you know, all these other series that have reinterpreted and taken Star Trek to new places. You have the building blocks of a foundation. Now, while I still think that they probably shouldn't have bothered to reboot it, one, he did a magnificent job.
I'm so glad they did, though.
I'm glad they did, because Star Trek's back, and we will be getting a Star Trek 2 at some stage.
And it's so good.
And it's such a good film, but it's also... But the thing, it does the beautiful thing of doing its own thing and creating its own universe while being a sequel, because it pays homage to that entire universe and says, yes, that still exists over there. This is what we're doing.
Yeah, we can't let him have that if we're going to let me have New Nightmare, because New Nightmare is the same kind of thing. Absolutely. It's like, though it is kind of a reboot, it is still technically outside.
It's still
the
within
franchise.
The canon, so it still fits. Yeah. All right, your number three, Josh.
My number three is an odd one, and I'm not sure if anybody here has even seen it. Cube Zero. Now,
I've seen Cube.
Yeah, if you see Cube is a really tight little low-budget thriller slash horror. And it's very interesting and it's intriguing and it's so goddamn different to anything that was out at that period of time. And then Cube 2 Hypercube came along and it's fucking awful. Like, it's just bizarre, and it tries to make it more than just the cube. Like,
the title misses the point of the first film entirely. Just by the title alone, Hypercube. No. The first movie was about
a cube.
Six people trapped.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it gives it all this sort of information and tries to expand it past the cube, so you learn about why the cube exists. And it's like, we didn't need to know this. This actually affects watching number one. And it's like, you're like, no. And then you watch three, and I started watching three, and I'd watch two the same way. It was like it was in a DVD pile on a 10 DVD buyer from the DVD store while I was there, and I'd put two in, and I watched one, and then the next one I was watching in the background while doing something else, and then all of a sudden my attention was captured, and this film is so good because it takes what two does and fixes it and then adds it into one and ends up completely turning around the whole trilogy
by creating
it's not amazing, but it sticks them all together, creates a whole series out of them, and then still gives you reasons and winks to the first one. So it's like it's faithful, it's well made, and I just really enjoyed it. And it was made on a relatively low budget, and it's good.
Would you have enjoyed it as much had you not seen Hypercube?
No, because there's things about Hypercube you have to know to to watch three. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. My number two, sticking with Richard's theme, is Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Ah.
Because here was a film that in 1979 we got Star Trek: The Motion Picture, and we all went, "Oh my God!" A big collective ugh. And then when Nicholas Meyer came along in '82 and said, "We're gonna let's do this up a little bit," and delivered what arguably is the saving grace of Star Trek. It's the film that basically corrected the universe, corrected the uniforms, brought pace and life back to it, brought back the camaraderie between the characters, added action back into the series, much needed action, and basically turned it into a great film.
It made it the motion picture that the first one claimed
to be. Exactly. It was the Star Trek movie that we all wanted to see. And we all went, oh, there we go. And we all lined up to see part three because part two restored what we were. But yeah, I remember when Star Trek 2 was like, are we really going to do this again? All right, so you're number two.
My number two is Fast and the Furious 5. So very recent inclusion.
I agree.
I'm going to go as far as to say this is one of the best action films this year.
I agree.
And I kind of, when they announced, I was like, really? Again?
Yeah, another one. And now I'm eager to see 6.
Now I really want to see 6. Absolutely. Yeah. So, look, I don't want to say anything. There's nothing more to say.
No, there's nothing more to say.
It's an action film, dude. It's in and out, just like the
There's
film.
Cars in it.
Yeah.
Fast cars, man.
And
Josh,
faster women.
You're number two.
My number two is odd because it's universally it's a universally bashed film. It is a Alan Smithy film. So a film
Even the filmmakers disowned.
Yeah, exactly. The filmmakers disowned it, and it's an odd film to watch because I've watched it probably 5 times now, and I actually refuse to let go of the fact that I think it's an incredibly good film. It's Hellraiser 4. Now, we had one. we had one which was great, right? 2 was okay. Like, it's not a great film, but it does some really bizarre things and takes it into some, you know, different territory. Hell on Earth, which is 3, is just terrible. Like, you have these inclusions of the new Cenobites, which are things like a CD launching chick, DJ, sorry, a dude with a camera for an eye. Like, it was just dumb. Oh, and a chick with cigarettes. That's right. All she does in the film is burn the girl like 3 times. That's her role. Uh-huh. That's what her ability is. What? Anyway, and 4 starts in space.
Now, space is good. We've already discussed
that. I know this. Now, it starts in space, and it's not a great film, so the dialogue kind of doesn't go over anywhere, and the sets are relatively low budget, but the guy explains that he's trying to end what started years and years ago. It then goes back to how the cube was made, then goes from that to another period of time in advance, which is modern day, which is him as the character, but at a younger age, where like he was building a building because he has these recurring dreams of the images from the cube, and then him interacting with the Cenobites and stuff like that at that level, and then goes back into the future and then finishes it. Like, finishes the series. And I'm like, you can't hate that. That's a
And then
really
they went on and made four more, didn't they?
And then they went and made four more, which
And did you hear that there's a new one?
Oh, wonderful. no, but this is what I'm saying. It's like the other four just have no connection. Like, they don't even try and pretend. But four finished the series, and you need to give it respect for that. On top of that, it doesn't do any of the dumb shit, has some relatively good Cenobites, has some great gore moments, and tells an interesting story arc. It's like, four was brilliant, and people should respect it for that.
I will have to have
it.
A look at it and in detail. I have actually...
I've got all eight if you would like to watch them.
I have all eight.
That's right.
I have
Did
all
you get
eight.
The cube thing?
No.
No.
No, because then if you undo it, they actually show up and they kill you.
Right. It's actually... I actually found out from a friend, though. It's not them. It's just some dude that's hired and he just shows up. He's a little overweight. Doesn't look anything like Pinhead. Just so you know.
Okay, cool. All right, here we go. Round of ones, and then we're going to get out of here. Right. My number one... Live Free or Die Hard. Die Hard 4. Right.
I love Die Hard 4.
Absolutely. No and argument. Here's a film that should not have been. Mm. Right? I mean, at the years after the third one finished, completely different
it
producers.
Killed the helicopter.
and McClane was back. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I thought Len Wiseman did a fantastic job bringing this thing back. Yeah. And it actually gives me hope for the remake of Total Recall.
And they've just announced 5 this week. Look, they've just announced a director for 5.
Yeah, I think it was a director. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to go for another one.
No.
You know, that the next one might end up on one of these lists,
I'm
too. You know?
Too old for this shit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's going to be McClane in a wheelchair soon, you know, but or a walker, you know. But look, I really liked 4, and I thought, wow, that was a really change of pace. Mm. Good on him. You're number one.
Number one is more because I was it the first... Oh, what the fuck I was going to say. Godfather Part 3.
Okay.
Because the first two were, again, perfection. And by the time I saw the third one, I actually... I didn't see most of them because I'm younger than you, David. I didn't see most of these until the mid-90s. So Godfather 3 had been out by the time I saw them. And by reputation, it was meant to be the worst. What it does, it takes Al Pacino...
See, do you know why it can't be on my list?
Why's that?
Because we didn't expect it to suck. Mm. When we saw it first run in cinemas, we were expecting another masterpiece.
Whereas I was expecting it to suck because by the time I saw it, I'd heard by reputation that it was terrible. And that's why I put it there. I put it somewhere because what it does, it takes Al Pacino and puts him in space.
True story.
It's in the cut. True. It's
you've
in the deleted scenes.
You've got to get the deleted
The Blu-rays, scenes. Definitely.
No, George Lucas amended edition.
Absolutely, there's Jar Wars.
It's got a CG
joke about that shit, man. Don't even joke about that.
In this one, Al Pacino blinks. Just when I think I'm out, they CG me back in. I really, by the time I got to see it, I thought, really? I almost put Alien 4 on here. What's it called?
Resurrection.
Resurrection. Because I after 3, I thought that was going to suck.
I'm right there with you, actually, on that one.
And maybe I should have put that there instead. But no. I put that there because it was, you know, a film I really like. And if it didn't have the Godfather name on it, it would be... it would probably be spoken about in Godfather terms as being
Look,
a really strong...
I'm one of those people who didn't hate Godfather 3. No, I saw it... Funnily enough, I saw a media screening of Godfather 3 because I was reviewing on 3AW at the time. And I remember... Because I'm a huge... huge fan of Godfather 1 and 2. I think they're the perfection. Mm. And I went to see the media screening and they held it at the ungodly hour of like 8 o'clock in the morning or something
like that.
And I went there, but they laid out croissants and, you know, coffee. And
not cannoli.
it was a really nice event. And we all went, we sat down, we watched it. And I walked out afterwards and I thought, it was all right. Mm. And that was the thing, though. It wasn't the masterpiece that any of the others had been. And there were parts about that film where you sit there and go, it let itself down, and if there had been no previous Godfather films, it would have been a great film. But because we have previous Godfather films, it's the weakest of the three.
It is the weakest of the three. But as a kid, it was one of those ones that, by reputation, I thought was going to suck.
Yeah. See, I once again, being old, I had the advantage of seeing it first run. So anyway, but yeah, no, I agree. I think by reputation, that film doesn't deserve the reputation it's got.
Mm.
I agree. Josh, you're number one.
My number one is Wreck 2.
I haven't seen the Wreck films, so yeah.
No.
I watched Wreck 1, and this film has become probably my favorite horror in the last like 3 or 4 years because it created a new genre of horror by doing the Steadicam, you know, sort of mentality through the eyes of
Didn't Blair Witch come first?
Yeah, but it doesn't count for me because it's like Blair Witch is like a reinvention of a story that somebody kind of made up, whereas this is doing its own thing. And also it was the first one to do it. Instead of having the shitty handy cam, they got a dude with a professional camera. Right. So you still get the advantages of proper shot work and stuff like this because the guy behind the camera obviously would know what he's doing. You don't have to have the mentality of having that person also in front of the camera because this person is by nature someone that will stay behind the cam and always film. So it's like it gave reason to use it. It was like, you know what, it's the evolution of that,
right?
And so the film was great. It put it together really, really well. It was a tight horror. It's an amazingly tense film to watch. And then they said they were making a sequel, and I was like, what? And then you watch the trailer, and it's just stupid. Like, it's got camera inside camera inside camera. Like, it's got a dude with, like, all three cams of three other people, and it's got, like, a team of people that are doing, they're, like, SWAT team and all this sort of stuff. I'm like, this is just stupid. Like, this is a dumb idea. We didn't need to go back. And you watch it, and it completely changes the storyline of the series. It changes what you thought was happening in the series and ends on a brilliant little cliffhanger. And it's like what you thought you knew about the series, you didn't. And you got to the end, it was like, it wasn't mind-blowing, but I was like, oh, all right, I'm happy. I'm happy with what I saw.
Yeah, because I remember talking to you a while ago. It was a couple of years ago, I think it was, when we first, and you said you weren't happy about Wreck 2.
No, I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy with the concept of what they were going to do with it. But it's like when you sit down and watch it without any sort of pretenses on it, it's actually, it's interesting because it's like if you were ever going to make a sequel, that was what you had to do with it. You had to do something that completely changed the formula, otherwise you end up with Hangover 2.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, it's like they completely went the other direction and it went fine.
Cool. Yeah. Excellent. These are all good lists. I like these lists.
All right.
Food for thought.
Yeah.
All right, let's get ourselves out of here. We got some feedback. I forgot. We got one feedback. It's from our friend Chris from Bruce Vegas.
Nice.
And it's aimed at you, Josh.
Oh, God.
It says, one word for Josh. Bereavement. Stephen Mina is the new John Carpenter. Chris from Bruce Vegas. So I think he's recommending to you a movie called Bereavement.
And then I will take that.
Okay.
And
I will put that in my bag. Josh will look into that and as our resident horror fan, and he will answer you next time, Chris. Thank you for that. And that was our only feedback. But if you do want to send feedback to our show, send it to feedback@filmactually.com. Drop us a voicemail at 02-8011-3167. Even though we're not doing the show live at the moment, we will still play your voicemails on the show. You can get our merchandise, join our fan page, follow us on Twitter, do all that stuff. Anything you want, just go to geekactually.com. You'll find it all. And we will be back live again in a couple of weeks. But for the moment, we'll just be putting these out on the feed. Josh, tell them where they can find out more about you.
RawDLC.com is a gaming website. Head over there and check it out. We've got a whole bunch of new stuff up and a new episode up. And we will have check our YouTube channel as well because I have a whole bunch of new Studio 33 stuff.
Fantastic. And your other site?
HipHopNetOnline.com.
Cool.
Yeah.
Don't forget to mention that one, dude. Yeah. And Richard?
As always, you can find me at therealbits.com. That's ELBits.com or on Twitter at DVDBits.
Fantastic. And we should just very, very quickly shout out Charlie and Brad's new podcast, Good Day, Sir. They've got a few episodes up now, so go check those out on iTunes or go to Rebound. Go find them at reboundradio.com. And of course, boys, where are you? We haven't seen a new episode of The Real Junkies in quite some time. I want to know. Write to me. Weekendronin.com is their home. Real Junkies is their podcast, their film podcast. They get drunk. They review movies. It's good fun. Go find out more about them. Josh Spencer, our cartoonist, attackninja.blogspot.com. Best domain name ever. Great artist. Go check his stuff out. Josh, stop eating the microphone. And...
I don't know, it's kind of hot.
He's no Sarah. Sarah had the boys all in a tiz on that one. Remember when she started to chew on the microscope live?
I just hated the sound. It was like a chomping teeth sound. It was just,
all right, remind people, our opening clip is from the film Final Destination 5. And, of course, we're going to end the show this week with a track. We couldn't get the Final Destination 5 soundtrack for some reason, but we do have the Final Destination 1 soundtrack. So we're going to play a track from Shirley Walker's original score for the Final Destination. You guys got anything else?
Nope.
Oh, one thing, if I may. There is the Sydney Underground Film Festival kicking off this week on September the 8th for those people in Sydney. Suff. I really want them to put an N in there somewhere, so it's going to be snuff.
Yeah, that'd be good.
One thing that's going to be interesting for all geeks out there is a film being played called Trilogy. And this sort of ties into the film news we've had this week. Some evil genius has spliced all three films from the original Star Wars trilogy into one film, where they've taken the first third of the frame from Star Wars, the middle frame from
That's just weird.
From Empire Strikes Back, and the final one from Return of the Jedi. I've seen a trailer for this. You can look it up on YouTube or on the Suff website, suff.com.au. And it's weird. Characters sort of emerge from one frame and end up coming out.
Oh, that's just bizarre.
It's weird, but it looks good.
All right, well, we'll have to check that out. Anything else? No? In that case, go see more movies. You don't see enough movies, and all of life's questions are answered in the movies. And we'll see you all next week. Bye now.